try and put together one or two things about Melville to tidy up the course a little, but make no pretense whatever of any kind of conclusive statement, of course. So I want to talk to you about the confidence man, confidence hyphen man, 1857, and Billy Budd, whose full title is Billy Budd, comma, Sailor, colon, An Inside Narrative, which has problems about publication. I'll come to in a moment. Now, the reason why I put Melville and Hawthorne together in this puzzle way is to make quite certain we hold these two people in our minds together. Now, those ideas we were looking at last time in the marble form about the idea of necessary fall, the fortunate fall, the idea of the destruction of innocent ignorance so that, in fact, you have a chance of becoming a human being rather than an animal or plant, is very much involved in all those ways in which Melville's heroes have a chance of becoming mature. I mean, the way Ishmael survives in order to tell the story called Moby Dick. The way Pierre does not survive, but has an inkling towards the end of the kind of impulses under whose power he is out of control, and so on. But more important, I think, than any of that, to my mind, in Melville, is the whole business in Moby Dick, as we saw, and in Pierre, and that is the destruction of any kind of absolute truth, the destruction of anything, any truth with a capital T, the destruction of any kind of certainty and any kind of authority that you might assume that certainty could have. Now, in The Confidence Man, you have, I think, the high point of Melville's career along these lines. I don't think this book is as... This book isn't as encyclopedic and as wrought as Moby Dick, but it's just as inclusive, and I'm inclined to think that The Confidence Man is, if we're going to grade these things at all, is Melville's finest book. It's subtitled His Masquerade. And the masks are worn in this book by characters on a Mississippi riverboat proceeding down the heartlands of America to New Orleans on April Fool's Day. It's an American ship of fools, in fact. And the revelers are a set of pilgrims who parody both Chaucer's pilgrims to Becket's shrine at Canterbury and Muslims travelling to Mecca. It's explicit. This is a parody of all pilgrims towards absolutes. They're Mugginses. Now, this sheer variety of creed and business on the ship shows that the pilgrimage is American. The ship, like the Pequod, federates them temporarily all along one keel in some kind of temporary quest or purpose. And we're told that maskers, I quote, interweave their foliage in the natural wood. But their variety of species remains. I mean, they're pines or oaks or whatever. And therefore, because it's temporary and because it is a natural wood, the potential chaos is incipient. I quote from the opening chapter. A Tartar-like picturesqueness, a sort of pagan abandonment and assurance. Here reigned the dashing and the all-fusing spirit of the West, whose type is the Mississippi itself, which, uniting the streams of the most distant and opposite zones, pours them along helter-skelter in one cosmopolitan and confident tide. And it's that word confident you have to watch there, because Melville is asking questions here. What is confidence? What is confident chaos? What's confident about the Mississippi such that you can make it an analogue of human life? Is that confidence? And notice the language of the tensions here, abandonment and assurance, dashing and all-fusing. uniting and opposites. The interpouring of all the tributaries into the Mississippi and confidence. This is the model of the pilgrim, the American pilgrimage. This is the field of action of the book. How can virtue and truth be defined in conditions of unestablished society? That's at the local level. There's more to it than that. The passengers are a collection, very largely, of fools in that they are all competitive. They're all vertically thrusting people with different ideas of what their businesses of life should be. And of course, like all competitive societies, it involves mutual deception. So this confidence is a matter of mutual deception. Therefore, it is a radical criticism of any kind of illusion that competitiveness can, in fact, be society. Now, at the center of this action is a single character who's transformed into many different images of salvation. But as we saw in Pierre, all philosophers of salvation are impostures, insofar as they say, I am the one. So what you have here is a central figure, who is the confidence man on this ship, who takes the form of a variety of religious and philosophical situations, salvations, and experiences. He is the embodiment of all those doctrines of imposture that we saw in Plotinus Plinlimon's pamphlet in Pierre. That is, this collection of people with this man in the center is a parody of all forms of the absolute which take upon themselves to call themselves panaceas, cures, beliefs of any kind. And these men are fools because it is human beings who perpetrate this idea on themselves, that there is a single panacea or cure or belief, which is one in which you can have confidence. The point is then that the Savior is a confidence man, a trickster, a con man, whose confidence trick consists in trading on the human urge for absolutes and utopias and other static ideas. The book then is concerned with all those futile dreams of final magic in which a man believes he can place confidence and then rest in peace. The thing about The Confidence Man in Melville, it's a very confident book. It's Melville's most complete, his best written, best organized novel. It is totally nihilistic. It's, putting it in its modern context, it is a myth of the origins of the need for mythology. And in its organization, it annihilates Socrates, Diogenes, Emerson, Poe, Christ, Satan, Vishnu, Buddha, and many more. It isn't very difficult to do. You mustn't, I mean, there's no point in thinking that Melville is doing something here which is extraordinarily difficult. The pleasure is in the ease. So the discussion or dialectic inside the novel exposes the history of Western philosophical claims to truth, insofar as they have reached America in the middle of the 19th century. Now this act, although I say it like that, this action is both comic and profoundly disturbing. The pleasure in the book is it's extreme radicalism and the extremely rare beauty of the writing. I mean by that, it has a sort of springy fineness to the prose, which this nihilism is structured, which is quite extraordinary. Okay then, and of course the boat is not now the Pequod, and the name of the boat is the Fidèle. So the Pequod hunt for control of the whale has become the Fidèle's hunt for control of other men. The name of the game has changed from exterminated Indians to exterminated faith, from Pequod to Fidèle. And the game for the reader is to watch the exposure of all myths and all philosophies presented as a series of avatars. And one has to use this word because I think it's a good word for what goes on. An avatar is a Hindu word which has got into the English language quite clearly and simply for incarnations or transformations or metamorphoses of the single thing. What you have then in the game in The Confidence Man is to watch the presentation of a series of avatars of the single saviour idea, the salvation, the single salvation idea. So, the book begins with an American avatar of all these confidence tricksters of salvation, who comes on the ship at St. Louis, in the center of the United States. Wrong book. The god is in fact a South American god, and therefore American. This is how it goes. Opening of chapter 1. At sunrise on a 1st of April, there appeared suddenly as Manco Capac at the Lake Titicaca a man in cream colors at the waterside in the city of St. Louis. His cheek was fair, his chin downy, his hair flaxen, his hat a white fur one with a long fleecy nap. He had neither trunk, valise, carpet bag, nor parcel. No porter followed him. He was unaccompanied by friends. From the shrugged shoulders, titters, whispers, wonderings of the crowd, it was plain that he was, in the extremest sense of the word, a stranger. In the same moment with his advent, he stepped aboard the favorite steamer, Fidèle, on the point of starting for New Orleans. Stared at, but unsaluted, with the air of one neither courting nor shunning regard, but evenly pursuing the path of duty, lead it through solitudes or cities, he held on his way along the lower deck until he chanced to come to a placard nigh the captain's office, offering a reward for the capture of a mysterious impostor supposed to have recently arrived from the East. Quite an original genius in his vocation, as would appear, though wherein his originality consisted was not clearly given. But what purported to be a careful description of his person followed. And there the whole book really is in those three paragraphs. Here you have the first avatar. Notice he's dressed in the milky and marble colours of Isabel and Pierre. The deadly whiteness of the whale, which invites human beings to colour it the way they want. And therefore he has no originality. He's just white. Here is the colour then of the absolute. And the whole opening to three paragraphs are very sinister. It's like Nova saying, beware. And notice he's allied to the legendary child of the sun in the Inca myths, Manco Capac, M-A-N-C-O-C-A-P-A-C, who was said to the legendary child of the sun, who is said to have founded the Inca dynasty of Peru. He is a classic cosmological figure of the origin of tyranny, masquerading as salvation. Manco Capac is said, in fact, to appear suddenly. Now, this figure of whiteness and lambness is fleecy, parodies the whiteness of Western salvation programs, especially their Christian version, and its iconography of purity and candor. The ship of fools, then, in a condition of faith, is exactly the situation in which this imposture is likely to succeed. He has no baggage, he's a stranger. But notice that, evenly pursuing the path of duty, we are told, he's so confident that he neither courts nor shuns regard. And then we're told later on, his operation takes place in solitudes or cities, in fact, anywhere. And the placard warns everybody on the ship, the pilgrims, of a mysterious impostor supposed recently to arrive from the East, that is, the origins of the religions of the West, and of course the direction into which the Pequod sailed in search of the absolute whiteness of Moby Dick. So, what do we say here? We say, just as whiteness had the variety of possible forms in Moby Dick, so the original idea of salvation has a genius for transformation. The idea then is this vocation having some originality behind it is not clearly given, but there are plenty of descriptions of it. It's an ideal description then of the pursuit of the absolute. The novel's opening is as amusing as it's dazzling in its irony. It's an alerting, discriminating warning to the reader that the information in this book is not for fools. Now, the unmasking of confidence men is carried through to the point where, at the end of the book, the images of light recur. Do you remember we had these images in Moby Dick of the inner light, and we had these images of the light of starvation in Pierre. Here, the light of faith is once again an oil lamp, as it is basically in Moby Dick, and here it's the oil lamp left in a cabin on the boat. At the end of the book, this oil lamp is turned out, and there's simply darkness and a bad smell, which is what Melville leaves us with. But that is the image of health at the end of the book. It is quite positive. It is not in the least negative. One wants to say that Melville's nihilism is complete and healthy. The last avatar of the confidence man observes that every man puts his trust in Providence and other men. And the novel, between chapter 1 and chapter 45, has shown exactly the danger of doing that. And now the hero observes, as he says, as he turns the lamp out, "For the good of all lungs, let me extinguish this lamp." And the last sentence, very famous one, the end of the action of nihilism, reads, "Something further may follow this masquerade." But at least the masks are off, and at least you're in the darkness without spurious light. And if you don't like the bad smell, do something about it. The chapter is entitled "The Cosmopolitan Increases in Seriousness." But also involved here is a very strange myth. That is the myth of the devil as trickster. The myth of the trickster is standard in most cultures, particularly North American ones. The devil as trickster is one of the standard great myths of the world. Now, if you look at Norman O. Brown's book called Life Against Death, if you look at the chapter on the Protestant ethic, you'll see in fact some paragraphs about this tradition within the Protestant West. It's in fact the English edition of Life Against Death by Norman O. Brown, page 219, that I'm going to quote. What Melville is doing here is using this myth and turning it on its head. Now this is a shade tricky, so I have to go very slowly here.
All I'm saying is that the tradition of the devil as trickster is used to undermine the structure of capitalism and the structure of something which is so awful about capitalism, and that is the structure of charity. That is the worst, I think, of the Protestant ethic, is that you have handouts and it's called charity. And the devil, you remember, has traditionally a bad smell. Now, the devil's bad smell is here turned to use and health. Let me quote Norman Brown. I take it, those of you who don't know this book called Life Against Death, I really recommend it very much. It's a very important book. We are beginning to realize that the mythical archetypes of the race, says Brown, of which the devil is one, say things which it is still not possible to say in any other way, unless psychoanalysis has found a way. Through the archetype of the devil, mankind has said something about the psychological forces inside himself, sustaining the economic activity which ultimately flowered into capitalism. The devil is the linear descendant of the trickster and culture hero type in the primitive mythologies. The trickster is a projection of the psychological forces sustaining the economic activity of primitive peoples. And the evolution of the trickster, through such intermediary figures as the classical Hermes, into the Christian devil, parallels the changing forms of human economic activity. Hence, when Baudelaire and William Blake declare the essentially satanic character of commerce, they exploit a great mythological tradition to say something which has not yet been said in any other way. Martin Luther's identification of the spirit of capitalism with the devil draws on this tradition of the devil as trickster. Now, I mention that just to bring us into line with exactly what is happening here, because the confidence man is the trickster figure in American form here. But what Melville is doing is suggesting that this kind of activity inside the capitalist structure can still be used. That is, that this kind of demonism is fundamentally a dramatization of energy and can work either way. Incidentally, there's a very interesting book which I've just begun to read. It's come out of Pederson, which I recommend, called Purity and Danger by Mary Douglas. And it's dead in the center of this kind of material. I mean, the dangers of purity. And there's a section on the trickster in which she links it up, this will interest you, Sister Anita, she links it up with Tyler Shudder. It's surprising, is it not? It's a very interesting little book, this, Purity and Danger by Mary Douglas, Paying the Pelican. She's a very good scholar. She's here at London now, in the anthropology department at University College. She has a new book out on symbols of cosmology, which is actually a masterpiece. But anyway, that's the kind of area then. Now, so what we've got here is a myth of energy, of human energy, because human beings have projected this mythology. And Melville's novel is clearing away some of the malign ideas about this trickster figure and showing he could be a possible preparation for health. Now, all the 40-odd characters in The Confidence Man, except one, are con men of some kind. The exception is, right at the end, an old man whom the confidence man leads away into the darkness. But he, too, is a self-imposter. The forms of the confidence man are a series of gentlemen. And they're characterized in various ways. I'm cutting this novel down quite a bit, as you understand. But they're all masks of trust and assurance. Each one of these men is saying, trust me in this way. The motto of the book is a sign which the barber puts up on the ship outside his barber shop in chapter 1. And it reads, no trust. This is paired with a slate in which this fleecy stranger traces successively the following phrases. Charity thinketh no evil. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity endureth all things. Charity believeth all things. And charity never faileth. Which, of course, is a splendid invitation to be thoroughly cheated. In each case, he rubs out all the words except charity, so that the five repetitions, I quote, remained throughout uneffaced, not unlike the left-hand numeral of a printed date, otherwise left for convenience in blank. Charity, therefore, is like the whiteness of the whale, or the whiteness of Pierre. Is defined in action under the pressure of will, necessity, and temperament. It is not an existent entity. It's a beautiful thing, you see, like you write up the word charity, and then you rub out its definitions. It sounds like all McLuhan condensed into just a few sentences to me. You know, this business of print idea, that the ways in which print harnesses notions and stabilizes them when they aren't really stable. In fact, chapter one of this book is so masterly, I find it quite breathtaking. It's quite extraordinary. You could spend quite a lot of time just analyzing it. Okay, then. If you look at the Oxford Dictionary, as I did, checking some of these notes, you'll find that the dictionary defines charity variously as Christian love of fellow men, kindness, natural affection, candor, beneficence, liberality of the poor, imputing good motives wherever possible, trust for advancement of education, institution for helping the helpless, and so on, so on, so on. All of which are social actions, all of which depend on the structure of society. The Oxford Dictionary then is exactly the activity in its definition which the confidence men operate to the point of no trust. So that, do you see what one could say, in fact, that that final darkness, when the light is extinguished, is real charity. The charity of relieving us all of the burden of faith. Let me just say two little things about this before I go on to Pierre, then. That is the basic structure of this book. At the end of chapter 23, the last avatar of the confidence man appears on the Fidel, characteristically in Melville's Games, at a town in America called Cairo. And this should raise in you all those references to Egyptian mummies and pyramids that madden in Melville, as origins, you know. This last avatar is called the cosmopolitan. He is the international man. He is the citizen of the world, who is ironically going to be the only true saviour, because he saves you from the idea of saviours. His image is the true sun after all the false suns. That is, he has no metaphors. He is in fact the modern sun god who extinguishes the lamp of artificial suns. He's the real sun god who puts men into darkness and saves them. In the final chapter, in this cabin on the Fidel, Melville shows a solar lamp hanging in the gentleman's cabin. And on its glass shade appears two figures. One is a horned altar, and the other is a robed man. The horned altar represents the old Dionysian religion of the goat god, which of course moved through from the origin of tragedy in the Tragos, meaning a goat dance, right through to the Dionysiac religions, right through into the Christian transformation of the devil, and right through into present-day Dionysiac ideas. Also on the lamp is the new religion of Christian prophecy. But you see, both are on one single original white lamp. They are both parts of a single thing. They are both shadows cast from a single white light. I quote, "The light of this lamp, after dazzlingly striking on marble, snow white and round, on all sides went rippling off with ever diminishing distinctness, till like circles from a stone dropped in the water, the rays died dimly away in the further nook of the place. Now you have two big images in Melville's works. The image of what happens to the snow white when you begin to colour it as a human being, and the fact that any idea, in fact, has no boundaries. It is, in fact, endless circles which simply dim. So you can link that up with the circles around the heads of Pip and Ahab in Moby Dick, and the mob of Pierre, and the colouring of the white whale. But swinging from the ceiling in the cabin, there are other lamps, all of which have been extinguished. And they're referred to as barren planets. They're either exhausted or deliberately extinguished. That is, they're the images of other cosmic sky gods. The sole remaining lamp is retained on orders from the captain of the Fidèle. I quote, "to be kept burning till the natural light of day should come to relieve it." Now, daylight is sunlight. And that is, when the true light comes, it will be without divine context. In this last surviving lamp's light is an old man, white-haired, handsome, imaged as Simeon. You remember in the Christian scriptures, the witness of Christ's coming as a child, who then, you remember, departed in peace. He's imaged here as a green summer figure through his imagic associations. He's not a confidence man, that is, a man who is deluding other people. He's a man who lives in a state of self-illusion. He lives secluded in ignorance, but to a certain extent untainted by the world. And we're told he has, this sounds just like McLuhan again, we're told he has the real news. That is, he has the Bible, not a newspaper. That is Melville's phrase, the Bible, not a newspaper. But when the cosmopolitan comes in, he gives him the Bible, and immediately the cosmopolitan begins to use some of its sayings to, I quote, distrust confidence in man. Because the whole point about the Old Testament, he says, is it's a book of gall and wormwood, because it says, don't trust in man. The book of transcendence. But in addition, in this book, between the Old and New Testaments, is something else called the Apocrypha. And this suggests the uncertainty of the word, the uncertainty of both Testaments, and doubt in any faith, because here between them is something which belongs to neither, which means they don't have boundaries. So the handbook of the confidence man could very well be the Bible, since it describes the power relationships between creature and creator in these uncertain ways. And then the Christ child appearing to Simeon is parodied by a dirty boy who comes in selling a very particular kind of salvation. And you'll see how hilarious this book, I mean, I'm solemnifying this book outrageously, but it's extremely funny. This boy is dressed in a fragment of an old linen coat, bedraggled and yellow, who comes into the room like this, into the cabin like this. This is in the last chapter. Barefoot, he came from the deck barefooted on the soft carpet, all pointed and fluttering, the rags of this little fellow's red flannel shirt, mixed with those of his yellow coat, flamed about him like the painted flames in the robes of a victim of auto da fe, that is, the Spanish Inquisition. His face, too, wore such a polish of seasoned grime that his slow eyes, S-L-O-E, sparkled from out like lustrous sparks in fresh coal. He was a juvenile peddler, or marchand, as the polite French might have called him, of travellers' conveniences, and having no allotted sleeping place, had in his wanderings about the boat spied through glass doors the two in the cabin, and late though it was, thought it might be never too much for turning a penny. Among other things, he carried a curious affair, a miniature mahogany door, hinged to its frame, and suitably furnished in all respects but one, which will shortly appear. This little door he now meaningly held before the old man, who, after staring at it a while, said, "Go thy ways with toys, child." "Now may I never get so old and wise as that comes to," laughed the boy through his grime. And then someone from one of the berths in the cabin says, "The devils are laughing now, are they? And what do the devils find to laugh about in wisdom, begara? To bed with you, you devils, and no more of you." This sharp-eyed boy, in fact, is demonic. He's another no-trust figure who undermines the confidence in man. He's a destroyer, a necessary destroyer. He's a satanic child playing with this toy open door, opening and shutting door. And it becomes, in the chapter, an image of false security. That is, you can have doors. The idea of a door is kind of ludicrous. So just as you must shut the door of your own light in cabin behind you for security, so this toy provides an illusion of safety from those who would steal from you. But the door has no lock, only a bolt from inside. But unfortunately, you have to buy that off the boy as well. And then even when you bought it, as the old man does, the boy says, "Now what about the window?" And he hadn't thought about that. So the boy has an answer. He said, "Well, you don't really need a bolt or a lock or this gun. What you need is a money belt." And so he sells the old man a bolt and this opening, shutting miniature door and a money belt. But then as he gives him the money belt, he throws in a paper which is entitled "Counterfeit Detector," just in case. It's in fact a beautiful image of the exposer of all the impossible myths of absolute security and absolute certainty of self and faith. The old man wants safety, but he's not a man of wisdom. It's the child who sells him the trap of the absolute. And it's the child who knows exactly what the cosmopolitan is up to. He says to him, "Look a lie and find the truth." You don't care about a counterfeit detector, do you? "Or is the wind in the east, you think?" he says to him, knowing very well this is where all these wretched gods keep coming from. He knows then who the cosmopolitan is, this last avatar of saviour ideals. The old man begins to twig a little bit of what the boy is like, because he refers to him as he goes out of the door as the public benefactor. When he comes to look at the counterfeit detector, he finds it's far too complicated to be used. Truth and falsehood being, as Pierre showed us, shadows of one nothing. So the solar lamp begins to dim as Melville presents his belief that men must have confidence in their own ability to discover meaning without authoritarian action. So he's saying what looks like security is in fact tyranny. The old man has a life preserver, and of course that doesn't work either. In fact, he's not quite certain whether it's really perfect or well soldered or quite tight. He keeps asking, "Is it quite perfect?" So he's led away into darkness, money belt in one hand, uncertain life preserver in the other, and the book ends. It's a marvellous, ironic end. The ship of fools, with its load of maskers peddling their material and spiritual salvations, presumably sails on April 1st. It's a book of ironic comedy of destruction, which is necessary. This feast of fools is a necessary destruction action, a comedy, a real comedy, not a comedy of reinstatement of social structures, such as you find in Shakespeare, but something far finer. And here then, through the quest voyage of the absolute down the middle of America, the newest country in the world, that may have been invented in the West, takes on a similar character to the movement across the Pacific in the Pequod, in these hunts, these quests for the absurd, absolute. But at the end of his life, Melville was still involved in this. Melville's life can only be considered exactly like the book. That is, what I've called in connection with Hawthorne, an equative life. I'm talking about people, these men are setting up equations that don't have solutions. They are providing dramatizations of information so that we can, in fact, have an opportunity to live without tyranny. At the end of his life, Melville was involved in a book, again about a ship structure, again, once again, about the making of a god out of absolutes, and once again concerned with tyranny and authority. It's a very different kind of book, as I'll try and show you. It was written, in fact, between 1886 and Melville's death. 5 years later. And it was left in a condition of unfinished order, and it's only in 1962 that a proper editorial edition was brought out. In fact, this edition here is the only edition of Billy Budd, which is the accurate. If you have a look at it here, you want to be careful about this, like, I don't offer myself as a counterfeit detector, but certainly this is in fact really the only edition, and you'll see from the preface just why. It's very important to get this edition because the names of the characters are different than the bad ones. So, it's not until 1962, ironically. Now once again then, he turned to the ship as the image of what he called in a book called Mardi, sociality. And here in Billy Budd he calls the sea commonalty. The sea commonalty, C-O-M-M-O-N-A-L-T-Y. Now within this ship structure he sets up three exceptional men as centres of different kind of authority over other men. Captain Vere, V-E-R-E, the captain of the ship. Claggart, C-L-A-G-G-A-R-T, the master at arms, that is the ship's lawyer and policeman combined, and Billy Budd, a young skilled seaman who attempts to make his personal character his own authority, which is a definition of innocence, I suppose. And the action is released from a very familiar climax in American literature and in Hawthorne and Melville, mutiny. The number of books in American literature that deal with mutiny is extraordinary. I mean, to do with revolt. There's never been a stable society, and you can tell that from the literature. What I'm talking about then is insubordination. Activity against state-constituted authority. In this case, represented by the ship's hierarchy. Not just the officers, but also the master at arms, who is the the lawyer and policeman. The lawyer and the policeman are always the stooges of those who control economic power. Now, Melville's historical context is a very important one. This is a British ship. Now this is important to note, because you know darn well it doesn't really matter finally where you go for this kind of thing, and one can talk about America in this way. But Melville is focusing on the fact that power structures are universal in the West along these lines. He's concerned here with the famous British naval mutinies of the Nore, N-O-R-E, in the early 9th century. The mutinies of the Nore. It's this is the context for this triad of main characters. Now, Captain Beer exercises social justice as a sort of Burke-type visionary of state order. I mean, Thomas Burke, the great English conservative, who very much believed in constitutional continuity as state authority. It's Vere who reads Burke in the book. And that is a clue. Of course, and as you know, this kind of state order and justice, especially in time of war, becomes very stringent. So that mutinous insubordination becomes treason when the country is at war. Claggart embodies something which state law can never punish, and that is evil. Nor can state law eliminate it. I'm using Melville's ideas here, not mine. Deep down inside Melville's work, right to the very, very end of his life, was this idea that there was something you could call evil in the world, which had nothing whatever to do with social justice or cures or panaceas. If there's one area where he still toyed with the possibility that there was an absolute, it was this one. He's very vague about this, I may say. It's to him some kind of natural or existential evil. It's a secular version of the Calvinist concept of natural depravity in fallen man. Now this is our link up with the marble fawn, you understand, you see? Because implied everywhere in the marble fawn, as I said, is this myth of the fortunate fall. The idea that somehow even an evil like murder can have its place in a structure of necessity towards good. Again, I must say this because I feel very involved in this. These are not my ideas at all. I think there's something else going on, at least I hope so. My God, if it was shown to me there was such a thing as natural depravity, I would be very worried indeed. Now, Melville then believes that there is a force in some men which cannot tolerate innocence, by which he means here open-hearted mutuality, comradeship, and love. And back we come with something you find in Hawthorne everywhere, and in American culture everywhere, and I reckon in Western culture everywhere, that there are certain kinds of men who are incapable of ordinary, non-competitive life of the heart and clear love of themselves because they are intelligent. Claggart is the figure you find in Melville and Hawthorne again and again, the man who is special, who is exceptional, who is intelligent, and whose head prevents the love of his heart and cuts him off from his fellow human beings. The third figure, Bud, as the name suggests, is immature. And the seamen on the ship regard him as a sort of special man, almost to the point of being a godhead, to be respected and worshipped as an ideal of uncorrupted manhood. Now, the plot is to go like this. Beer, Captain Beer, has to sacrifice this godlike Bud to the principles of Burkean social justice in which he believes, even when the charges against him are made by Claggart, a man incapable of love and comradeship, and therefore radically under suspicion. That is the plot that Melville thought up, which is darn near diabolic. because it consists of so many assertions which have to be unravelled to see it. And if there's sneaking into my remarks a certain lack of respect for this book, you're right. I've got a feeling this plot structure's loaded. So, what happens then is that Bud is accused, not of murder, but of mutiny in the first place, which is treason when the ship is at war. And then, because he knocks Claggart down, manslaughter with extenuating circumstances. Now, even Claggart recognises the innocence of Bud, meaning by that, as I said, open-hearted comradeship and love. But he necessarily must oppose it with his intellect. He's a man of, and it's said explicitly, all this, I am not making any of this in my own words, this is the language Melville uses. He is a man of the head, a man of analysis, and a man of satire. That he's exactly the man that Matthew Arnold was suspicious of, and therefore said that Pope and Dryden weren't poets. And nor Burns, by the way. You see why Matthew Arnold didn't like Burns. Well, he's a sexy satirist. That's enough for Matthew Arnold. Also, his body is odd. He's pale with the wisdom of the serpent. Bud strikes Claggart in inarticulate fury. You remember, this violence, where he strikes Claggart as he makes these accusations against Bud, is a violence which replaces speech. It is the body's action of self-defense when the word fails at the crucial moment of trial, at the moment of radical injustice. Vere and Bud find that touching Claggart's body when it's dead is, I quote, like handling a dead snake. Bud is hanged from the cross of the ship's main yard, and the world's seamen, later treat that cross like the Christians treated the cross of Christ. Bud then lived as a God-man made by men, as all gods are made by men. But he finally becomes a god after his crucifixion, after his death, in the mythical imagination of sailors. And the reasons, of course, have already been written in Moby Dick, Pierre, and the Confidence Man. But notice, and I must say this because any sort of simplification here will be wildly inaccurate, Billy Budd is not a simplified god hero. He's associated with mutiny and with the rights of man, which was the title of his first ship. And that, of course, is the title of one of the greatest works to do with the structure of human freedom by Tom Paine. And it is the opposition between Paine and Burke at the end of the 18th century which is the centre of the French, American, and the incipient English revolutions. This book is about revolution. That is its plot. It is about the nature of the challenge of authority. It's one of the, to my mind, one of the very greatest novels or books that deals with that subject. As I say, my reservations are to do with the way it's done, the loading of the stuff, the Claggart stuff. Okay, the political guardians then of the novel are Tom Paine, representing the rights of man, and Edmund Burke, I said Thomas Burke just now, I'm so sorry. I mean Edmund Burke. Tom Paine representing the rights of man and Edmund Burke representing traditional constitutional authority. But Billy Bard transcends this division. Look how Melville opens the book. He opens it and he closes it with a worshipped sailor. He opens it with the idea that he found was around of the handsome sailor, capital H, capital S. That is, a man worshipped by other men because of his beauty and because of his uncorruption. And the novel is dedicated itself to a man Melville himself had deeply admired as an example, to Jack Chase, Englishman, wherever that great heart may now be, here on earth or harbored in paradise, captain of the main top in the year 1843 in the United States frigate, United States, which, remember, was the ship Melville joined in Honolulu in order to reach Boston again when he was 24, which is what I was talking about in the first lecture last October. But the initial handsome sailor of chapter one is, I quote, and you'll see how deep Melville is going here, a native African of the unadulterated blood of Ham. This is a reference to Genesis 9, where Noah curses Ham, and the curse was popularly thought to be that his skin became black. Edgar Allan Poe uses this with an awful lot. So did the Puritans of the 19th century, and so did the various early pro-slavery pamphlets and so on and so on. It's a major document, Genesis 9, in the history of slavery. This black, beautiful man is huge, joyful, and associated with the Assyrian worship of a sculpted bull. And all the handsome sailors of the world are said to be among the followers of this bull worship. And the image is like Aldebaran among the lesser lights of his constellation. That is, Aldebaran, you all know, is the brightest star of the constellation called Taurus, the bull. And here we are with Melville then saying what the origins of gods are. They are in fact great men. Not intelligent men. They're something else. Very difficult to find an intelligent god. Billy Budd then is another one of these god men of all the bull cults. But he is blonde and white. And he's a man of no exceptional intelligence. He's referred to as a barbarian. He's an outsider, like the confidence man, or Bartleby, or Ishmael, or Ahab, or Pierre. But on his first ship, the Rights of Man, he was a peacemaker. He was the foundation, in fact, of peace in the sociality of the ship's community. And when the press gang come aboard the Rights of Man to recruit for war, even the officers of the Rights of Man are reluctant to see Billy Budd go, because he's required by anyone in a class structure. But he is pressed into service on this new warship called the Bellipotent. And as soon as he comes on board, Vere sees him as, I quote, an angel of God. But the angel of God is finally hanged for mutiny. Notice that even at the end of the book, while he awaits the sentence to be carried out, Billy Budd's own piece is said to be a trance, which the Christian chaplain of the ship can't disturb. This has nothing whatever to do with denominational religions, this book. In fact, the minister, the chaplain on the boat, is referred to, because he's minister on the war boat, as the minister of the Prince of Peace, serving in the host of the god of war, Mars. Now you can see that this is in fact a complex structure. It's a very short book in terms of length, but a very condensed one. And it is about, as I say, this relationship between revolution and the exceptional man, in this case, of peace. Melville's images for Budd in the book are all predominantly animal, as most images of primeval innocence are. His name is, in fact, the name of a god, Budd, a Celtic god. And he's imaged as a Celtic Apollo at one point in the book. Hyperion, Hercules, and as I say, the Celtic god Budd or Hud, and another form it takes, Belly, B-E-L-I. And this is connected up for Melville with the Oriental god Budd, B-U-D-D, the sky god of victory and victorious energy. Claggett, you can put now, I think, in this big context that I've been very much concerned with in this lectures this year, right from Charles Brockden Brown's figures like Ludlow, right through Melville, of course, into the 20th century. You go right through to figures like William Burroughs' Dr. Benway. Everywhere in American mythology there is this figure of the intellectual man of darkness. And you'll recognize that, like Charles Brockden Brown's Corwin and Jack London's Wolf Larsen, there are many figures in Hawthorne. It's the eyes which are the centre of power. When Claggett accuses Budd of mutineering dangerously, a whole set of relationships of intellect through the eyes comes in. The lights, those lights of human intelligence losing human expression, were jellidly protruding like the alien eyes of certain uncatalogued creatures of the deep. The first mesmeric glance was one of serpent fascination. The last was as the paralyzing lurch of the torpedo fish. You see, there you can feel Melville grappling with something he feels is there, in nature, or whatever, that some basic morphological fact he feels. That there are men who are like the torpedo fish, that there, you see, they are like a species of aggressors. It's a familiar pattern in, as I say, in Brown, in Hawthorne, in Poe. That is that Melville is building Claggett very carefully out of a much wider tradition. Let me carry on a little bit about Claggett before I stop. He is a man of, I quote, more than average intellect. He has black hair around his pale face, He's a man of constitutional sobriety. Nothing of the Dionysus about this guy. And he has, I quote, a peculiar ferreting genius, which operates to the mysterious discomfort, if nothing worse, of any of the sea commonalty. He's a man of, and I quote, exceptional character. And we're told that his depravity is that of a man, and I quote, dominated by intellectuality. And I quote again, a mind peculiarly subject to the law of reason, but whose heart, and here is the key quotation, riots in complete exemption from that law. This is one of the most extraordinary images in Melville of the dangerous person in the world. A mind peculiarly subject to the law of reason, but whose heart riots in complete exemption from that law. And it aims, Melville says, at effecting the irrational. That seems to me a magnificent description of what I would myself call evil. All I'm saying is that, for me personally, I wouldn't make it an absolute. Again, the language for Claggart, he has a bonfire in his heart. And he has a magnetism which is, I quote, makes his conscience nothing but the lawyer to his will. And it's very significant that Bud kills him by a blow on his forehead, which we're told was so shapely and intellectual looking. So Melville Claggart is part of his final mythical vision of existence. Melville had a myth too, which he couldn't penetrate through, I think. I quote, finally, this image of Claggart, which I think we better close. With no power to annul the elemental evil in him, though readily enough he could hide it, apprehending the good, but powerless to be it, a nature like Claggart's, surcharged with energy as such natures almost invariably are, what recourse is left to it but to recoil on itself and, like the scorpion, for which the creator alone is responsible, act out to the end the part allotted to it? What you have in fact is two parts of nature in this novel at loggerhead, Bud, Claggart. We're told, for instance, that Bud is nearer to unadulterate nature, and Claggart is then, as we've just seen, surcharged with energy as such natures almost invariably are, as the other polarity of that. It's just somehow Melville had a myth, finally at the end of his life, of a polarized relationship, which he needed to make a stable fiction. But it's an equation, again, because Vere, the man of law who has to commit Bud, is not sure whether what he's done is finally right, because he can't be. So there is that letard from the absolute at the end. Okay, that's it. As I say, both these, I've radically simplified these two books in order to put them together in your experience. But you'll have to go through it quite a bit. So.